This is the NBC Theater. From the NBC Theater in Hollywood, we bring you an hour-length adaptation of H.M. Tomlinson's novel of adventure, Galleon's Reach. The radio version is by George Lefferts of NBC. And at intermission, you will hear a transcribed commentary on the writings of H.M. Tomlinson by Dr. Harvey Webster, the director of education by radio courses at the University of Louisville. Here now, the NBC Theater production of Galleon's Reach.
Beautiful summer afternoon. The sky over the Thames is burnished and coppery. The city murmurs quietly, and through the bars of my cell at Aldgate Prison, I can see the gulls soaring and swooping against the sunset. Although I am a prisoner, I share in the freedom of the soaring bird, for I have found freedom in the events which shaped me. The story of my search began many years ago, on a day much like this. I was a small boy. The steamer moved up the river at half speed. The sounds of life fell with the sun. I remember how the ship caught the last of the light and reflected it in the face of the officer who stood on the bridge, superior, exalted, brooding down over us, the passengers. I remember that there was an old man, and he frightened me when he spoke.
And there is the great smoke pot, London. London.
Nearly home, Jimbo.
So grave to a child, the word home. It announced the unknown, the fearful. I looked ahead, and to my child's eye it seemed as if the ship were drifting toward a darkness, which reached almost to the top of the pale sky shot with blood. My father placed his hand upon my head. I remember his words.
There you are, little Jim Collett. That's the place for you, London. You'll make your fortune there. See it?
But I could see only the darkness. I tried to look through it, catching snatches of conversation from the other passengers. Meaningless words at the time. More meaningful now.
I haven't seen this river since the year the Princess Alice was lost.
Who was that princess? Had she appeared in my storybooks?
They never hear from him afterwards. He was afraid, but he went.
Who was afraid? Where did he go?
Yes, he was afraid. Call it fortune, luck, or fate, it's the same old dream. I suppose we can't live without dreaming. The man didn't want to go, and yet he never came back once he'd broken his ties. This river has seen a lot of that sort. It's a river of dreams.
Some dreams come true. Here's London to prove it.
Prove it? Proof of what? The dream is true if you have it. There's no reality. What's the good of it all? What if he never did come back? I tell you, there are other worlds.
Where are we now, sir?
The tall, bearded old man sighed and answered.
Galleon's Reach. For some, it's the end. For others, a point of departure.
And as he spoke, out of the night across the water, as though to show that he was right, there came a fluttering of air, the call of an unseen ship. And so I came to London, and I was afraid. Between Fenchurch and Leadenhall streets in London, there is a region of grey limestone and glass, horizontally stratified into floors, intersected by narrow avenues. Within its deep recesses, there is guarded treasure. This treasure, however, is invisible. It may be viewed only by confidential initiates, and even they cannot see it except as symbols in ledgers, bills of lading, bank drafts, warrants, indents, manifests, and other forms of treasure specifically designed to puzzle moths and tax assessors in their work of corruption. The region has no beauty. When I was a young man, I took my trade here with a firm that bore upon its door a brass plate with the inscription Teriums. The master of the dynasty that dwelt beyond the brass plate was Ephraim Ferriam, Esquire. You sent for me, Mr. Perry?
Mr. James Collett, remain standing.
Yes, sir.
You work for me, Mr. Collett?
Yes, sir.
6 years. You started as an office messenger?
Yes, sir.
I pay you a rather good salary.
Yes, sir.
And recently you were promoted and placed in charge of labor relations with those human beasts of burden who unload my ships.
I supervise the men, sir.
Exactly so, Mr. James Collett. And I believe I have told you that Perriums cannot allow the men at the warehouses to argue with us about the hours they will work. Is that correct?
Yes, sir. However, sir...
However, I am in receipt of your memorandum, passing along to me the matter of the hours. I should like to know, Mr. Collett, why you have not settled it yourself. Well, I am waiting, Mr. Collett.
Isn't that a bit outside my province, Mr. Perriam? The men's hours are fixed by union contract. It's for you to say whether we respect the contract or sack the whole lot of them.
Mr. Collett, I dislike supervisors who put their own responsibility on me. May I ask what you are here for? It would seem you are unable to face your job. Are you afraid to sack these men?
I am on good terms with them.
I don't like that, Mr. Collett.
It is necessary if you want your ships loaded. The union...
You can recognize no unity in the world other than your unity with Perriams. That is what pays you. Now that we speak, I see that you are an impertinent fellow, Mr. Collett. I put it to you. What will you do about this situation?
I don't know, sir. I haven't thought about it.
Mr. Collett, a man who cannot make a decision has no right in your position. A man who takes a position he cannot fill is nothing more than a cheap swindler. Say something, Mr. Collett. That blasted quietness you flaunt in my face cheats the man who pays you.
Mr. Perriam, I consider I have done a good job for Perriams. However, in my 6 years here, I have come to recognize that you do not want to hire a man, you want to own him. You're a bigot, a greed-filled, power-crazy tyrant,
my
and
God.
I dare say you haven't a decent relationship with any man alive, including your own nasty self.
Why?
I am certain that if you died this instant, they would be dancing in the streets before sundown. You may consider this speech my resignation.
So this is the trash I took from the streets and elevated to a position of dignity. You... You pig!
Mr. Perriam... But it was no use to call Mr. Perriam, for Mr. Perriam was dead, and I, James Collett, had killed him. I left the building, left the old man lying on the floor of his office, his eyes globing toward the ceiling. I must have walked for hours without the slightest idea of where I was going. As evening began to fall, I found myself in a strange place that might have been the forgotten lumber yard of creation. Shapes that could not be published towered over me, high masts, skeletal riggings, empty hulls. Against a high wooden fence, there was a name board, its letter big enough to announce the location to a great distance. Something clicked in my mind as I read the word galleons. And for a moment, I heard the voice of an old man speaking from long ago.
For some, the end of a voyage. For others, a point of departure. Galleons reach.
Good evening, sir.
Good evening.
Excuse me, but are you the passenger for the ship Altair?
I beg your pardon?
I'm Mr. Sinclair, the first officer of the Altair. I was to pick up a passenger here at Galleons Reach. Are you he?
I'm afraid not.
Oh, sorry to trouble you.
Not at all. I wish I were going with you. Where are you bound?
Calcutta, then Bombay.
You don't happen to need an extra hand, do you?
No, but we are short of purser. Are you serious?
I don't know. What does the purser do?
Keeps books, passes out stores, checks on the cargo and bills of lading.
Sounds too much like the job I just left. Besides, you wouldn't want me.
Why not? You seem an intelligent enough sort. Pay isn't much, but...
Well, I'm afraid I couldn't. Much as I'd like to.
Family?
No, I'm quite alone in the world.
Position?
I have little of there.
I'll sign you on if you like.
You wouldn't want me.
Why not?
I just killed a man.
Oh, yeah. You've been pulling my leg, haven't you?
No, I'm serious.
By heaven, I half believe you are. When did all this happen?
A few hours ago. I've been walking around ever since, trying to screw up enough courage to go to the police.
You don't look or speak like the sort to murder. How did it happen?
I don't really know.
My employer was talking to me, saying some rather nasty things about me, when suddenly I saw red and pushed my fist in his face. He fell forward, and I saw that he was dead.
Perhaps he had a heart attack.
Try convincing the police.
Oh, yeah. It does sound like a bad fix. Was he a nasty old fellow?
He was.
Huh. What a pity it wasn't old Perrin.
What did you say?
I said pity it wasn't old Perrin. You wouldn't know him. He used to own the Altair. Oh, Lord, the times I've wanted to punch that imperious nose of his. What's the matter? You ill?
It was he.
Who?
Perrin.
What about him?
I'm trying to tell you, that's the fellow I killed.
Now, look here, old man.
It'll be on in the papers tomorrow. You can verify it.
Stranger, the uses of Providence. Look here, Collett. Why don't you ship out with us?
You don't know me.
I'd be willing to sign you on. No one need ever know about this business but you and me.
I really don't.
Ship with us. We'll drop you at Bombay or any port en route. Or you can return with us.
How often I've thought sitting at my desk that there must be another sort of life outside. The fellow were only bold enough to smash the cage. And here's my cage, half smashed already, with freedom waiting on a ship.
Sometimes men are afraid of freedom. Is that it?
Oh, I'm struggling with my standards. My upbringing, my class tell me to go to the police. My romantic self tells me to fly away like a bird. After all, I can always come back.
That is a question, Mr. Collett. Can anyone ever come back?
I could hear the old man again.
He didn't want to go, and yet he never came back.
And I began to know what he meant. The Altair went downriver on the first ebb, past shores I had not seen since I was a child of six, away from England, away from the past, yet bearing fragments of the past as I went. I discovered that the life of a purser is not all bookkeeping, and I discovered that there was more to Mr. Sinclair than I had suspected.
Well, Mr. Collett, how do you like life aboard the Altair?
I didn't know a purser's job included chipping rust off a deck with a hammer.
Oh, when we're short-handed, we all take a turn at the rust. It's a fight, the rust, or us. Relax for a moment.
Where are we now?
This is the Aegean Sea. You're familiar with the Odyssey?
Oh, somewhat.
See that tiny island off the port bow? The one with a tiny house sitting like a white cube in a desert?
Mm. I can make it out.
A girl lives there. I call her Circe.
Oh? Friend of yours?
I wave to her each voyage. We've never met, but I like to fancy that she waits for me. No leopards or swine, of course.
And that line of white along the shore would be the bleached bones of the sailors, hmm?
I see you have read the classics, Collett.
Mm-hmm. And you too, Mr. Sinclair.
We must have a talk one day. My person down in the engine room is an authority on Homer.
Sailors are a peculiar lot.
The sea gives us time to think.
It seems to be kicking up a bit.
Yes, there's a beam sea setting in. Makes a roll.
I like it. It shakes off the heat. It
smells like a storm coming up to me. Oh, they can be quite nasty in these waters. There's a message in that breeze. We'll be in for it before nightfall, or I miss my guess. Where's the coffee?
How's the ship? Is there... I mean, what's the danger?
She'll make it all right. She's a good ship. I'd better finish my coffee.
What's that?
I don't know.
She seems to be rolling like mad. What's that chair?
Good Lord, our rudder must have gone. Come on, we've got to get up to the bridge. Give me a hand.
Aye.
Look out for that wave. He's by the head. One of the boat heads must have gone.
The storm isn't letting up.
I wonder what... There's another boat head.
Oh, it's a abandoned ship. Abandoned ship.
we managed the boat, I'll never know. But by the time we'd pushed clear of the altar, her forecastle deck was a raft of wreckage and almost flush with the sea. Then I heard Sinclair's voice from the stern of our lifeboat.
She's going!
The altar gave a hollow, rumbling groan and slid headfirst into the sea. I saw the shape of the propeller almost over me. Confusion on the surface of the waters, the great swell rocked the boat. And when I looked again, the sea was bare. In an hour, the storm seemed to abate a little, as though it felt its job were completed.
Keep a watch by the halyard there.
The storm seems to have gone.
Yeah, lucky for us.
What are our chances?
If we can keep on this course, we ought to be picked up.
I see, Alf. Have you noticed where the gentleman's room is located?
Men seem to be taking it well.
Yes, the reaction. But we'll have a rough time of it before we're rescued. You can depend on that.
The days that followed bore out Sinclair's words. 5, 6, 7, 10 days went by. The sea was calm, the sky blue, but it grew hotter and hotter. There was no shelter from the white fire of the sun. There was no singing now either. We spent our hours peering beyond for the chance that would end our misery. Time lapsed into an uneventful fortitude, a thirsty desert in which our own apathy could see no reason of relief. The sail of our parched boat was double-reefed and goose-winged. There was little attempt to steer. Once hope was exalted.
A light! I see a light!
Be still there. It's only a star.
I see it's a light.
Be quiet.
I tell you it's a light. There's a ship coming.
Oh, shut him up.
Oh, shut me up, is it? There's a light up that I say, and no one's going to keep me from it.
Light that.
I'll kill the man who tries.
Hey, he's got a knife.
Look out. Thanks, Collard.
Ah, he's loony.
Sinclair.
Don't worry. He'll be all right in the morning. The rest of you men try to sleep.
Ah, if we could give him a drink.
I keep up it, my mouth covered with gum.
Oh, but a drink.
Shut up.
The men lapsed into silence like statues. Nobody moved. Nobody. It was only a deep humming. That was the world droning in space. The men were floating off. Their weight was gone. There was nothing.
Collett. Collett.
What is this, Sinclair?
Look astern. To windward.
I see nothing.
Keep looking. I wondered if I was seeing things.
Nothing I see. I think you're right.
It is a light.
Oh, star.
No, no. It's getting bigger. It's coming toward us. Look, it's a ship heading right for us.
A ship! Men! Men! Men, it's a ship! It is a ship!
The liner was black, with a long, round row of ports like circles of gold. She was enormous. Someone was shouting at us from the bridge. Along her rail was a row of silent figures. I remember thinking in astonishment, women in white dresses are looking down at us. And then the world went black. I spent the next 2 weeks sunning myself on the deck, contemplating fate, wondering where it would lead me next. On the 14th day, I was seated in a deck chair next to a dour-looking passenger. We were paying little attention to each other, I thought, when he leaned toward me and spoke.
Feeling all right now, I suppose, huh?
Oh, yes, yes. Thank you.
Nasty thing, a shipwreck.
Yes.
My name is Norrie. Call me Norrie.
Mine's Collett.
Care for a pipeful of tobacco?
I'd like one, but I don't have a pipe.
Oh, I'll loan you mine. Oh, go ahead. I know how it is without a smoke. Oh,
thank you very much. Very good. Thank you.
What happens to you fellas after we land at Rangoon?
Rangoon?
Well, I suppose any old place would be an outing after 3 weeks in an open boat. Hmm?
Do you know Rangoon?
Oh, I know most of the peninsula from Burgatoyi to Bangkok.
The names sound attractive.
Do they? Yes, I suppose they must have sounded attractive to me once. Disillusionment set in. Mm-hmm.
That's the worst of disillusionment. The real thing goes.
Yeah, what do you mean by that?
Oh, just my way of doubting reality.
Oh, you'll understand reality well enough when you bark your shins on it.
Was my shipwreck a reality, or was it a dream? Can I ever really know for certain that it happened?
Did you experience it?
I experienced dreams, too.
What sort of reality are you looking for?
I don't know. I've just begun to think about what I'm really looking for.
Ah. Well, now, me, I'm looking for an important metal called cassiterite. It goes by troy weight, or by the ton, if it runs to it. And when I find that, I'll be very loving. If I don't, I won't be happy at all. No, sir, not at all. Cassiterite is reality to me. Now, your abstractions wouldn't turn my scales with a martyr's crown as makeweight.
I wonder if you'd look twice at the scales if you really knew what was in them. Well, certainly I'm not seeking martyrdom. It's too lonely.
I wonder. You talk like a Christian. You, really have no plans when we dock at Rangoon?
No. I'm a destitute seaman.
No. You're no sailor. More likely you're an escaped embezzler or a missionary.
Take your choice.
How would you like to come into the jungles with me and search for cassiterite?
I know nothing about prospecting. Can't see why you'd want me.
Well, first of all, I don't like getting malarial fever all alone in the jungle. Secondly, there are the natives. They can be very volatile. If they make trouble, they might get you and not me. You see, a partner has many advantages. Don't let me persuade you, though. I want you to come only if you feel like it.
And so I drifted into another sphere of life, a sphere where the names were like music. Mulmine, Martaban, Kavoy, Mergui. At Rangoon, Nori and I took another ship, the Penang, from which our prospecting expedition would begin. And as we approached, I came under the spell of the Orient. Even the sea was transfigured into a shining expanse of carnelian. The very air was a rosy glow of heatless fire. I felt as if I were assuming another nature, entering another life, a life whose only affinity to earth was a faint odor of pepper and the sound of a gong.
From Hollywood, the NBC Theater is bringing you a dramatization of Galleon's Reach by H.M. Tomlinson. If you're interested in supplementing your enjoyment of these NBC Theater productions with home study under college supervision, be sure to listen to the announcement at the close of this program. And now, our intermission commentator, Dr. Harvey Webster.
It is most appropriate, I think, that the NBC Theater ends its admirable series of dramatizations of contemporary British fiction with a little-known work of a too-little-known novelist of great distinction. Since it began in the summer of 1948, NBC Theater has pioneered bravely in the field of radio. It has had faith that what the most discriminating few call good will be thought good by the potentially discriminating many, if the many are allowed to hear. Novels at a more timid age of radio would have called impossible to dramatize, it often has done with superlative excellence. James Joyce, Sherwood Anderson, D.H. Lawrence, the often fearful names of the great, have been brought to you, and you have liked them. NBC Theater has proved that entertainment does not eliminate illumination, that the great of our age can be pleasant listening, good reading, and highly profitable to our understanding of ourselves and others. The Peabody Award, the National Council of Teachers of English Award, the Ohio State Institute on Radio Education Award for two successive years, and a high Hooper rating prove the point. H.M. Tomlinson, one of the older and still very modern writers of British fiction, will seem to you, before this hour is over, a very wise man who should be better known. Like Conrad, whom he resembles but never slavishly imitates, he can be mistaken as an adventure story writer. In Galleon's Reach, there is what might be called a murder, an adventurous sea voyage, a trip through the jungle. There are strange and believable characters like Captain Hale, Jim Collett, Parcell, and Norrie. You can read or hear it as fun if you will, or if you wish, you can read and hear it as a grim and significant commentary on man's fate in the modern world. H.M. Tomlinson is a modern Thoreau who writes novels. With originality, he echoes Thoreau's generalizations that most men lead lives of quiet desperation, and that progress has too often meant the ability to communicate nonsense for thousands of miles. In his admirable travel book, The Sea in the Jungle, in his perhaps best novel, All Our Yesterdays, in the fine novel you are hearing dramatized today, he shows vividly one view of the modern dilemma. We honor the engine, not the man. We can fly over mountains, but not conquer ourselves. We can worship money, but not God. We have made ways of living, but not learned how to live. Right or wrong, he makes us think and criticize ourselves. He makes us feel and understand others. He does not tell us where the good world is or how to find it. He does make us more aware so that perhaps we someday will. Like all, or almost all, of the admirable NBC dramatizations, this presentation of Galleon's Reach should help us to find ourselves and a better world in which to live. All praise to NBC Theater, its director, actors, and writers. May it continue to be honored and to deserve it.
Thank you, Dr. Webster. Our radio version of Galleon's Reach will continue from Hollywood after a brief pause for station identification.
Never forget the morning Nari and I left Penang to go into the Burma jungle after rare metals. Nari had asked me to meet him at the home of Ah Loy, the Chinese trader who had outfitted our expedition. I went by rickshaw to Ah Loy's, through a gateway flanked by a pair of porcelain beasts, into a garden, into a pinkish house not unlike a temple. A genie clad in blue admitted me, bowed, and led me to an inner room where I waited, examining vases, shelves of books on everything from mathematics to theology in every conceivable language. The silence hung heavy as drapery.
You are interested in philosophy, Mr. Collins?
It's interested me to see those books. You are our lawyer, I take it?
Yes. Are my books out of place?
The truth is, I looked at your books only because I hadn't the courage to get closer to that jade vase.
The vase? Come and handle it. Such things are made to be touched as well as looked at.
Thank you. This is very beautiful. Feels much stronger than it looks.
Sometimes I wonder whether Western culture turned into chimney smoke because of a neglected sense of touch. You see, Mr. Collett, when you handle an object, you must pause and wait and examine it. You have to change your mind about it.
I see. Is Nari here?
He will arrive soon. Do you know him well, Mr. Collins?
Only a little.
A little of Mr. Nori is good. You will join my wife and me for tiffin?
If it wouldn't inconvenience you.
It will be no inconvenience at all, Mr. Collins.
This is my wife.
How do you do, Mrs. Alloy?
Is she not a rare beauty, Mr. Collins?
You will have a singer to drink, Mr. Collett?
No, thank you. Not before breakfast.
Mr. Collett has not been long in Penang. Give him more time, my love.
Yes. But is he not a friend of Mr. Nori?
Mr. Collett is an admirer of jade.
A collector.
Oh, no, Mrs. Alloy. I only admire. Oh,
then I shall like you, Mr. Collett.
My wife does not like Mr. Nori. He's different for each of us.
He is evil.
No. He's not that. He is a sad man, really. He knows too much and he has accepted too little. I am sorry for Mr. Nori.
Why do you say that?
Because for him there is no ultimate value. It has been killed by his science. The formulation of dirt. It is very sad.
As he talked, I found I couldn't keep my eyes from the face of his wife. She was not a Malay, though slender, in a green sarong and white muslin tunic. She's hardly Chinese and certainly not English, even with that abundance of brown hair. Her beauty almost caused fear in me. She listened not so much to what you said, but to the reservations. Her face was wide with a delicate chin. She would have been a rarity in a court of Kubla. Later, as we journeyed upriver toward Kuala, I spoke of Atanari.
So, you like my Chinese friend, our lawyer?
Oh, very much.
Well, that shows your good taste. Our lawyer is rather too rare for my taste sometimes, though. I feel as if he doesn't belong with a body. He's only a subtle appreciation of refinements.
I liked his wife. I had breakfast with him.
Oh, you're honored. She won't eat before me often. I'm too coarse. You've never seen anything like her, I'll bet.
No, I haven't. What is she?
Dad, her mother was Siamese. My father was a Scotsman. I feel almost like a bishop when I look at her.
I wonder if I'll ever see her again.
Will you ever see England again?
I wonder about that, too.
There's one thing I can promise you. You can't see them both. You must make a choice. Penang or Berkeley Square. Come on, we'll be at Kuala soon. Another hour and you can ponder life in the Burma jungles.
The sun was lord of the country when we finally got the expedition underway. Nori led the way solidly at an enduring gait. Our Malay guide, Matt, followed, and then the native carriers, eight of them. I brought up the rear. And thus we wandered for many weeks, far beyond the verifications of a map, which proved to be more hearsay than cartography.
Chen! Chen!
We'll rest here a while before we push on. How do you feel, Charlotte?
Oh, hot. Tired and hot. How long are we going to keep this up?
Until we reach the right kind of geological strata, the cassiterite. The signs are good. All the bright promises of Earth. Isn't she good to leave us signs?
Maybe she didn't leave them for signs. Those who were not meant to be followed, just accepted and enjoyed.
Dear Collett, there he goes with his philosophy again. But I'll have to repeat it again. I want to own something. I want to give the moths and rust a chance to corrupt something that really and truly belongs to me. I suppose you don't share the itch with
me. Oh, on the contrary, if you lift the lid off a hoard of treasure, I'll be the first to dance a Highland fling. But I don't feel it owing
you. Do you know, Collett, I grow more and more certain that you're a Christian. I believe you'll come to no good end.
Don't you like humanity, Nari?
No, I don't trust them. You just look at humanity messing up its planet with progress, shoving things about, piling them up, getting cockeyed with deep religious conviction while it continues to suffer. No, I'd rather believe like the Malay. They shoot off firecrackers to keep the evil spirits off. As for the rest of your Western civilization, I tell you, it's enough to bring the Olympian sanitary inspector down on us.
Nari, I never would have guessed it before. But you're a frightened man.
Well, you can call it what you will. And I look life in the eyes in the hope of finding some reason in it. My little insides turn pale. Come on, let's find a stream and do a bit of healthy gravel washing.
On the 20th day, we reached an isolated mass of white limestone, rising like a lofty island in an ocean of jungle. Nari appraised the cliff with a professional eye.
You see that cliff, Collett?
Hmm?
That's what's left of an earlier skin of Malaya, a fragment of prehistoric hide.
It seems pocked with caves. We'll have a devil of a time trekking around it.
Oh, we won't trek around it.
You aren't going to climb it.
But that, my friend, is precisely what I intend to do. Yes, we'll make camp right here, and you and I can climb up to the first strata.
But what about the natives?
Oh, they won't go near that cliff. They think the caves are filled with hantus.
Hantus?
No, evil spirits, shadowy people. Stronger than firecrackers, even.
Well, do you think we can climb it without help?
Well, we'll find out when we try it. Come on, you better get started. Yeah. Good exercise, eh, Collett? Ah, I'm puffing like a steam engine. This exertion isn't good for a man with fever in the marrow of his bones. Yeah, throw me that canteen like a good fellow.
Yeah.
Oh, Lord, I'm trembling like a baby. Ah, sorry, I put a good-sized dent in your canteen, I'm afraid.
Yes, that's it. I'll pick it up for you.
Wait a minute.
What's up?
That rock where the canteen scratched you. Would you hand it to me?
Certainly.
Yeah. I can't believe it.
Why, what's up?
You know what this stuff is, Collett?
Hardly.
Well, I hope you can still dance that Highland fling. We found what we came for. This is cassiterite ore. It's loaded.
Looks so unimpressive. I thought it was dirt.
So it is. And there's an acre of it. You and I are rich men, Jim Collis. Well,
what's wrong, Nellie?
Is it getting dark?
Darker? No.
I can't seem to stop my teeth from chattering.
You're trembling like a girl.
You better get me back to camp. I've got a touch of jungle fever. It's cold. It's terribly, terribly cold.
We had found treasure, and it was a fraud. I felt in that moment that of all the frauds of the sensational drama of life, this joy on access or riches, this elation on the discovery of treasure as though it were wealth, was the silliest. Norrie's illness on the eve of the discovery taught me there was nothing in it. More was lost than was gained. Somehow I managed to half drag, half push Norrie back down the trail to camp. That night he lay in his hammock, yellow and motionless, hardly breathing. I sat beside him smoking. The silence stretched out before me into an illimitable league of nothing, a depth where it could never be disturbed. Next morning, the high cliff overhung the encampment, so that the sun found us only with difficulty. In the early cool of the forest, the calling of birds gave depth to the surrounding obscurity. One bird was tolling like a bell. Another was a blacksmith at an anvil. Another sounded like an idle boy learning to whistle. Well, now you're looking better.
Huh.
You'll be up on your feet in no time. How do you feel about the discovery?
The cassiterite? Well, hard to say. I'm purged of dross, in a way. Fever and timid, don't you? I'm pure. I've got salvation. But I feel pretty badly.
What do we do next?
Head back to Penang, stake our claim, hire some good mining equipment, and proceed to become independently wealthy.
Sounds so pat.
It'll be hard work, you make no mistake. We'll have to raise some money for bulldozers, steam shovels.
Bring in and destroy this beauty. Hmm?
Look, I told you when we started this search that I was searching for cassiterite. Not the answer to the riddle of life.
You weren't even looking for happiness. Just dirt.
Are you going to get metaphysical on me and ruin my joy at having finally made my fortune?
If it can be ruined so easily, it must be outside you.
Oh, now look,
Carl. Just a minute. I think there's someone outside.
May I come in?
Who the devil? It's an old man.
In the middle of the Burma jungle, that's nonsense.
But do join us, sir.
I hope you'll excuse me. I've lost my way. You see, my Malay guide, an exceptionally good man, was killed. I'm trying to make my way toward the China Sea.
Well, come in. You look as if you had a difficult time of it.
I was very glad to see your campfire. My name is Parcel.
Parcel the Ethnologist.
Oh, you know my name?
I should be a fool if I didn't know it. Collett, this gentleman is the world's greatest authority on primitive culture. Why, I think your books are responsible for my coming to Burma when I left school.
I trust I haven't misled you.
No, I misled myself. What point are you making for, Mr. Parcel?
Mount Birching.
Birching? But that's impossible. Mount Birching has never been penetrated. Hardly anything is known.
Very likely.
Well, you can't make it alone. You can return with us to Penang when you're rested and fed.
That's nice of you, but I believe I'll push on. I'll just stay the night.
But that's suicide.
I know the direction.
Call it. You try to persuade Mr. Parcel. Mount Birching is raw virgin jungle. I wouldn't try it with 50 men.
I've lived in the jungle most of my life, sir.
You aren't a young man, Mr. Parcel.
I can manage.
Not on Mount Birching.
I wonder if you'd mind if I spoke to your carriers. They're Semang, aren't they?
Mostly Semang, yes. A few Sakai.
You will excuse me, I'm sure. Most interesting culture, the Semang people.
But Mr. Parcel. Mr. Parcel! How do you like that? He walks up without a word to talk to the natives.
Well, either he's quite mad or the most foolhardy man I've ever seen. Look at the man. Bald head, high dome, skinny as a rail. Covered with jungle ulcers he doesn't even seem aware of. And he stands there chatting with your Malay boys as if he'd known them all his life.
Oh, the Malays stand in awe of him. I've seen it happen before.
Oh, why?
Well, they think he's a madman.
Well, why stand in awe of a madman?
Oh, the favorite of God, I believe.
Oh, a wizard, huh?
Yes, exactly. Look at how they respond to him, you see? He already knows more about those fellows than they know about themselves. And they sense it.
Do you think he'll make Mount Birching?
No. But he won't attempt it if I can stop him.
What right have you to try?
The world can't afford to lose men like Parcell.
I don't think you'll frighten him out of it, Norrie.
At any rate, I shall try to dissuade him. There are enough ghosts in these jungles already. Come on, let's have another go at him. Mr. Parcell! Mr. Parcell!
I've been having a most interesting chat with your Malay guide, sir. Did you know one of his parents was Tuchong? There's an old skull formation.
Mr. Parcell, I ask you once again not to attempt Mount Birching tomorrow.
But my dear sir, my work is far from finished.
But you can't possibly make it. You'll die out there.
I've considered that, of course.
But you speak as if it didn't matter.
And do you think it does? Now, if I may wash up and borrow some food from you, I'll...
What is the use? All right, yes, my guide will take care of it.
Thank you, sir.
Well, that's that.
Now, of all the harebrained fanatics, in the Middle Ages, that man would have been a holy martyr. Now he's a scientist.
What can we do to help him?
Do? What is there to do? Hang on, man. Why did he have to turn up? Isn't life complicated enough? I can't go doddering across Malaya, wet-nursing an inspired crackpot who's out for the Holy Grail. There are quite enough worries in life without having to decide what one ought or ought not to do. Well, goodbye, Mr. Parcell.
Goodbye, sir. And thank you for the supplies.
You won't take a rifle?
I'm sure I should know how to use it, thank you. Goodbye, Mr. Collins.
Look at him. Wandering into the worst jungle on earth like a child after some wildflowers.
Amazing man.
He'll die. He'll probably stagger off some cliff.
Harry.
Yeah? What's eating you?
I'm going with him.
You say that again. Perhaps I got it wrong.
I'm going with Mr. Parcell.
Oh, don't. I don't believe it.
What else can I do? I can't let the man die.
Well, let destiny worry about that.
I don't know what destiny means.
Oh, now, don't go metaphysical.
Well, he can't be allowed to go alone. You've got a fever. You'd never make it. I'm free.
Well, so is he. He's free to stay here.
No. No, I don't think he is free. He's obsessed by what he's doing.
Well, you're free.
Exactly.
Well, so there's nothing to argue about.
Nothing.
Well, who made you his keeper? Will you answer me that? Well? Oh, of all the blether, of all the sacred, predestined, inevitable Gothamites, isn't one fool enough? Now, what's he doing? Leaving his luck, turning the other way, toddling after an old crank who is looking for something people won't look at even if he finds it.
Well, that's not the point.
Well, what is? No, I suppose there's no use talking to a noble conscience. It invents its own reasons. Ah, call it. Let him be. Now, he'll fall sick with fever and some malaise will bring him back down to the coast.
But you can't depend on that. No, Nolly, no, I'm going.
Oh, all right, then go and be hanged. I'll have nothing more to do with you. Flaunting a noble nature in my face, making other people feel inferior and ashamed of being ordinary men. Go on, I'll have no more to do with you.
Goodbye, Nolly.
Jim.
Yes?
You'll need a good rifle. Yes, take mine.
Thanks, Nye.
I'm sending Matt with you.
Well, he won't have time to get ready.
He's all ready. I expected you might decide to do this.
You're a pal, Nye.
Yeah, but mind my advice. Don't let that old fool linger. He'll want to sit down every 10 feet and talk to his soul. Now, you bully him. Beat him. Win his respect. It's the only way to treat a great scientist who doesn't even know where he is. He'll never listen to reason. You must order him about until he cries.
We walked away from each other, and I knew that since our first meeting, we were two men already separated, already on different trails. I turned back once to see Norrie standing and looking after me. He raised his rifle, and I mine, and then he vanished forever. I knew I should miss him. Norrie was an old sentimentalist at heart, easy and warm, but he had armored himself bright in guiles like most cynics and epicures. I looked ahead then at my new companion. He was lurching along the trail, examining the foliage as he went. His putties were almost comical, like an urchin's stockings. They were no better than dirty bandages slipping down from his skinny knees. The leeches were already active on his legs.
Mr. Parcell! Mr. Parcell! Come along, Matt.
Yes, Tuan.
We've decided to go along with you.
If you'll have a seat.
Fine. I'm glad of your company.
Before we start, though, you'd better fix those putties of yours. They'll never last that way.
Huh? Oh, thank you. I hadn't noticed. I was thinking of something else. As a matter of fact, I decided that we should camp right here for the day. This is an excellent place, and I need some time to arrange my notes.
Mr. Parcell, we've only just begun.
But still, my notes are vital.
Besides, this is a bad site. Now, we'd better move on till sundown.
Yes, but my dear sir...
You couldn't work here. The sand flies would eat you. Now, come along. Agnes, you lead the way.
Yes, Doyle.
But really,
up we go. Watch the trail, Mr. Parcell. Hey, careful of that sinkhole. Move on, move on. I managed to keep Parcell moving until nightfall. When we pitched camp, it was quiet and there were no mosquitoes about. Parcell worked for a few hours until darkness and then spoke to me about his newest project.
Up here, all around us, Mr. Cullen, are strange, shadowy tribes of people. People who may know secrets our culture has bypassed.
You think such tribes live in this area?
I'm certain of it. And I will find them. Every tribe I meet mentions them. The shadowy, elusive people who avoid everyone. They're suspicious of others, afraid of us. But I think that if I went into the jungle, I might persuade them to take me in and share their secrets with me.
That sounds like a vague belief, Mr. Parcell.
Scientific discoveries all begin with a vague belief, Mr. Cullen.
I trust you won't try to find them without my help, sir.
I will find them in my own way and in my own time. Good night, Mr. Cullen.
Matt?
Yes, Doyle.
Keep a watch over Mr. Parcell tonight.
A wizard, Doyle? Who can keep watch over a wizard?
Why do you think him a wizard?
Where else would he find his strength? He has the strength of a whole tribe.
Perhaps you're right, Matt. For he on honeydew hath fed.
Doyle?
Allah sustains him.
Yes, Doyle.
Good night, man.
Good night, Tuan. Tuan, call it. Wake up.
What is it, Beth? Where's Parcell? Speak up.
Tuan, an evil thing has happened. Tuan Parcell is gone.
Where?
Into the forest, Tuan. He must have left when I fell asleep.
Did he leave tracks?
The rain has washed them.
Oh, come on.
Tuan, if you would permit me, we should consider first in which direction. It is difficult for a man to consider while he runs.
Yes, of course. We'll head toward Mount Birching. We must keep within shouting distance of each other at all times. Let's hope he hasn't been swallowed up by something. Come on. Sweat trickled down the back of my hand. There was no sound.
Mr. Parcell! Matt!
I might as well have sung out for old Perrin. It was already beginning to grow darker. The rocks and trees looked inhuman. In the glassy stillness, I imagined there were shapes at the bottom of the sea. The sun had gone. I stopped a moment and listened. Great lichened hammocks of rock crouched round me like gray beasts. Sable pillars receded like the endless aisles of an unholy tabernacle, but I had no desire to see its priest. All around, huge roots coiled in everlasting agony, and there was not a sound. If Parcell were left there all night, very likely he went mad. No wonder the Malays called the place forbidden. In my path, suddenly, I confronted a huge fallen tree trunk. I tried to climb over it, thrusting the jungle creepers away from my face. Suddenly, the rotted wood gave way, and I was dropped kicking into the choking dust of the hollow trunk. Something struggled with me, slithered past, making obscene, prehistoric sounds. I was trapped inside the tree. The desperate stuff broke away in my hands. I rested a moment to soothe my panic when... The ants were on me like fire. They bit like the points of red-hot wires.
I knew I had to get out of the Eden. Somehow, I'll never know exactly. I broke and tore my way through the rotted trunk into the dusk. My body was bruised. My tongue felt dry and thick. I started to walk into the blackness when the woods began to sigh and whisper. I knew that a tropical storm was in the making. The wooded aisles filled with quivering blue fire. The trees downed. And then there was a rolling of drums, the steady boom of the coming calamity, and the bony shouts of the host that followed the drums. Were they men? No, no men in these woods, only ghosts. My tired, feverish brain told me that the ghosts were having a night out. The entire mountain was hollow and booming. They were marching out of it, up their valley, an army of them. It was their place, and I was trapped, my back to the wall. I strained my eyes against the blackness toward the shouts. They were juttering toward me now. I could hear them. And like a floodgate, my jungle prison opened. Great skeletons of fire capered around me, arms about the trees. The trees leapt. They had no weight. The roots were flinging out of the earth, lashing at me. Serpents of fire punishing my body and my soul. The floods poured down like torrents of romping fire. The valley was going. I could feel it. The mountain was collapsing and running down, taking me with it for nothing.
Tuan Colin. Lies, Tuan.
What happened?
The fever. Yeah. I found you lying here in the mud. It is a fever. Come, Tuan. We must get back to camp. Let me help you.
They turned me out. The ghost turned me out of forbidden land. If only they could make a good spook out of me. And they turned me out. They kept myself. They took him in. He was one of them.
After that, it seems as if we walked for centuries. My body moving by itself, detached, supported by Matt. The fever burned at my brain. I felt remote, cleansed, far away. Matt looked at me sometimes as we stumbled through the jungle, and I knew he thought I would die. Yet in my mind there was no fear. I wondered about Parcell and decided he was a most successful old person to have been taken in by what he wanted. I wondered where Nolly was. I thought about Sinclair and the ship, but all of them were on the other side of time, across the pass. It was all right if you didn't expect anything but dreams. And now the world became extraordinarily quiet. I realized that Matt and I were in a canoe floating down the river. The trees moved by in a long and level line. But the country was distant and had nothing to do with me. I decided in my fever-ridden mind that we would get to the end of it presently, when we'd sunk down far enough. Everything went past as we sank down, and there was nothing to do anymore. I didn't even need to watch it all go by. Three weeks later, when I had recovered from the fever, I walked into the lounge of the Penang Hotel. A hand fell on my shoulder.
Collett, you old rascal. Jim Collett.
Sinclair.
Oh, let me look at you. You're thin.
I've been ill. What are you doing in Penang?
Waiting for my ship to turn about. I'm off to London tomorrow.
London. Does it really exist?
What about you?
I'm going back, too.
Not to Galleon's Reach?
Yes.
You can't mean that.
I do.
But there's a ghost waiting for you at Galleon's, isn't there? Old Perium's.
Very likely. But I've had a lot of time to think. I'm going back to lay his miserable old ghost once and for all.
Oh, I'd see it in purgatory first.
But actually, it's not Perium's ghost, Sinclair. It's my own. You brought me out of Galleons on your ship. Now I'd be grateful if you'd take me back. You see, I've learned in the jungle that the ghosts really run the show.
But why return to all that wretchedness?
Because our ghosts govern us, Sinclair. And it's no fun for us, really, unless we obey the order we know. And so I came back and sailed once again up the river of my childhood with the same officer shining and exalted on the bridge. It was twilight when I knew I was there at last. The people who were with me on the second voyage were shades in a dusk. I could not recognize them. There was a vague woman in a pale dress beside me whose face I could not see, but I could feel her consoling fingers in my hair. And an old man stood up who somehow accorded with the dark and the sound of the warning river. Which voyage was I actually making now? I know not. But there can be no chart of what is of enduring importance for a man. Infinity cannot be charted. For each man, the voyage begins and ends at Galleon's Reach.
You have been listening to Galleon's Reach, an NBC theater production of the novel by H.M. Tomlinson. If you wish to increase your knowledge and appreciation of literature, we suggest that you might enjoy the college-supervised courses now being offered in connection with the NBC theater. For full information, write to NBC Theater in care of one of the following universities or colleges: the University of Louisville, Louisville, Kentucky; the University of Tulsa, Tulsa, Oklahoma; Kansas State Teachers College, Pittsburgh, Kansas; University of Arizona, Tucson, Arizona; Texas College of Arts and Industries, Kingsville, Texas; and Brooklyn College, Brooklyn, New York. You also have a chance to win a set of the famous Encyclopedia Britannica. Several of the universities and colleges offering these courses are giving the Encyclopedia as prizes to the students doing the best work. Enroll in a supervised course, and you may be one of the fortunate ones to win the Encyclopedia Britannica. With today's broadcast of Galleon's Reach, we conclude another semester of NBC Theater dramatizations. We will return to our academic ways in the autumn with an exciting list of novels. And in the meantime, all summer long, that is, we urge you to be with us at the NBC Summer Theater, same time, same place, for a happy series of radio entertainments. Next week, for example, we bring you a presentation of the international prize-winning film, Monsieur Vincent. And in subsequent weeks, a first radio performance of Jean-Paul Sartre's engaging work, The Chips Are Down, a new version of The Doctor in Spite of Himself by Molière, Sidney Carton by Charles Dickens, Hedda Gabler by Henrik Ibsen, and other such notable works. Galleon's Reach was adapted for the NBC Theater by George Lefferts. Our intermission commentator was Dr. Harvey Webster, whose commentary was recorded. In today's cast, Whitfield Connor was Collett, Herbert Rawlinson was Parium, Tudor Owen was Sinclair, Collins Vane was the Cockney, Ben Wright was Norrie, Don Diamond was Alloy, Alma Lawton, Mrs. Alloy, and Raymond Lawrence was Postel. Your announcer, Don Stanley. The director of the NBC Theater is Andrew C. Love. This program came to you from Hollywood. What's on NBC today? Today, Gertrude Lawrence and Franch Othone help to ring down the curtain of the fifth season of Theater Guild on the Air when they star in Call It a Day. And for still more comedy, hear Phil Harris and Alice Faye in their bright show, followed by The Adventures of Sam Spade. For great listening, keep tuned here. This is NBC, the National Broadcasting Company.